Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled, Whose God Is It? Religion in the U.S. and Europe. Speaking will be Jane Kramer, European correspondent for The New Yorker, and Jan Ross, staff writer for Die Zeit, a German weekly newspaper. We begin with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzenska-Gross.
As the title of our event indicates, we are going to have a look this evening at the role of religion in American and European societies. And we are particularly privileged to have two very exceptional speakers on this topic this evening, and I'm going to introduce them now to you. Jane Kramer is very well known for her letter from Europe. She has written for The New Yorker for more than 20 years. She's the author of 8 books, among them 9, sorry. I never can keep up with this, of course. I'm naming only 3 of them. The Last Cowboy, Europeans, and The Politics of Memory. And she has been the recipient of many, very many prestigious American and European awards. And she divides her time between Europe and New York. And Jan Gross writes on politics and foreign policy and has had a series of prestigious positions in major German newspapers. He's now a staff writer for Die Zeit since 1998. Before joining Die Zeit, he was a staff writer for the Berliner Zeitung and Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. He has written 2 books, one on German domestic policy and its roots, and the second on the Pope John Paul II. And now we'll start with Jane Kramer, please.
It's been a very busy few weeks for God, our subject tonight. Pope Benedict XVI, for 25 years, the chief inquisitor at the Vatican, known as the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, went back to Regensburg, where he had once taught, and delivered a speech called Faith, Reason, and the University, and quoted some unfortunate 700-year-old remarks about the Prophet Muhammad, which set off protests and demonstrations, not just all over the Muslim world, but including the Muslim world in Europe. And it was a harmless enough speech, if you read it in its entirety, which almost nobody did. It addressed, in its many theological digressions, the Kantian fallacy and the history of irrational versus rational interpretations of Christian imperatives. And it was addressed mainly to the fact that the church had been losing members, mainly to what's called secularism in Europe, but in many parts of the world, to evangelical Christianity. The other strong force for religious radicalism in the world right now. But the remarks about Muhammad came early on when the Pope referred a German translation of a series of dialogues that had taken place in 1391 between the emperor and a quote at the emperor, a Byzantine emperor, Manuel II Palaiologos, and a quote, educated Persian interlocutor, and about Islam and Christianity and the truth of both. And you all know the story of that. It was written down during the siege of Constantinople, and it was not a cheerful moment for a Christian potentate to be contemplating the nature of Islam. But the offending quote, in fact, was, in a sense, addressing a question that was on everybody's minds right now. And that question, of course, is why at these moments of history does inquiry, or you could call it doubt, or you could call it dissent, become a kind of treason and, to some people, death-deserving apostasy? And why do we, in America, as well as among Islamists, why have we begun to theologize not only war, but hegemonic politics? Are we, in fact, in one of those historic cycles, the part where humanism gives way to scholasticism and fanaticism, or are we exaggerating? Are we being manipulated into fear by the fact that we have lost so many of our old reliable measures of reality? In other words, has the revolution in communications rendered those old measures inadequate and, in fact, woefully inaccurate in terms of describing and assessing the world we live in now? We've assumed in the last 20 or 30 years that mass communications could be a progressive tool, would perhaps even be a way to break those cycles. We now know that it can just as easily jumpstart them. It's worth remembering that it took centuries to mount the crusades that Palaiologos referred to. Today, a constituency for jihad, or indeed for a moral majority here, can be raised over the internet in a matter of hours. So how different is the moment we are in now from those earlier, longer cycles, and how do we deal with that as liberal societies? We're not doing such a great job here. The second question is, how susceptible are we in the West to this same kind of mass indoctrination? Call it the phenomenon of literalism, as American scholars of charismatic Christianity often do, or call it the undermining of imagination or of metaphoric capacity, or call it jihad, as scholars of charismatic Islam do. The question is, to what extent is the West, as well as the East, becoming God-besotted and even God-possessed? So if you start with the United States, the statistics, which everyone knows by now, is that some 37% of the population has been born again, which is to say, has had a transformative visit from the Holy Spirit that cancels all other imperatives, constitutional, pluralistic, secular, as in separation of church and state secular, and converts politics into a form of holy war, even when, as is the case domestically, that war is institutional and constitutional, which is to say, fought with modern Western methods and not at home with real weapons. Here are the figures for the mainstream churches in this country. They now represent only 15% of church membership, and there are schisms within them. A good part of the Episcopal Church is now in the throes of a charismatic revival, a kind of high church version of the tele-evangelical megachurch revivals, which both liberal and traditional Episcopal bishops are struggling uphill to circumvent. The Catholic Church itself has a sizable charismatic movement, and not only in Africa and Latin America, but here. The Baptists, as you know, have split as a church on this issue, and the most significant change within American Judaism over the past few years has been a rush to what you could call ecstatic orthodoxy. Think of the Lubavitcher movement, also a missionizing movement, not only in the States but in Western Europe, where immigrants from the East have made the sect the fastest growing Jewish community on the European continent. A few years ago, I wrote a book about a militia in Northwest Washington State, part of a movement that owed a great deal of its appeal to Western mythologies about the God-given right to bear arms against a whole conspiracy theory box of enemies. Call it the theologized constitution movement. It also owed a great deal of its strength to its association with crackpot sects like Christian Identity, which were themselves linked by money and membership to the Aryan nation. But most important, while the movement itself wasn't enormous, it thrived because of a particularly accommodating social context, an evangelical population for whom the idea of a holy war was not at all anachronistic or even strange. And it didn't matter whether the enemy was Wall Street or the Council on Foreign Relations or the UN or big government or the Antichrist, which tended to be the enemy of the moment. What mattered was a warped theological imperative to violence. It is not just or such a big jump from a backwoods paramilitary training camp in Washington State to our government in the other Washington, a government that came to power on an anti-big government platform and that has proceeded, as you all know, to claim more executive power than any administration in the history of the country by theologizing that claim. If you read the very fine article by Joan Didion in the last New York Review of Books, you know that by doing this, Bush has exempted himself from the constraints of more legislation than all the presidents before him combined. And I would say that he has gotten away with it in part by transforming the idea of government and also of American entitlement into what you could call a Christian mission, really a Christian duty. A few years ago in California, I stopped at a sporting goods store in Pasadena to buy a pair of sneakers. The very nice clerk who waited on me said that he lived in Orange County, which meant a commute of about 2 to 3 hours each way, depending on traffic. And when I asked him why, he said that the Holy Spirit was more prevalent in Orange County. He could get his instructions better in Orange County. So when the White House invokes an axis of evil instead of a simple enemy, it is not hard to understand that the president has a uniquely receptive audience in this country that he might not have in other countries in Western Europe, though certainly in some. Don't forget that the country rallied against communism not just because it was totalitarian or wrong or economically disastrous as a system, but because it was godless. The definitive work on how susceptible we have been historically to this sort of conflation really remains, to my mind, Hofstadter's classic 50-year-old essay, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And I would suggest, I've been doing a lot of reading for this, I would suggest that you might take a look at a book by Brooke Allen, which just came out, called Moral Minority, Our Skeptical Founding Fathers, which is a very tonic look on how determined the framers of the Constitution were to circumvent all theologizing of the new republic. So really, I want to suggest that we are really not so immune from the kind of fundamentalism with which the radical Islamists have been holding Europe and America hostage since 9/11. We know the causes, alienation, discrimination, in some cases poverty, but they do not explain the process of those revolutions any better than the internet revolution does. I knew a militia leader in Maine who got on the net and within 12 hours was able to raise a people's army of 500 people, all of whom converged on his house in a remote town in the woods of northern Maine with their rifles ready to train for the big fight against Satan. I know similarly, teenage Muslim boys in Amsterdam who got on the net last year and within a few hours were in a jihadist cell. And by now, some of them, I have been told, are en route to northern Pakistan to trade for their fight. There are more than 15 million Muslim immigrants officially in Western Europe now. There are actually millions more if you count illegal immigrants, asylum seekers, and family visitors who simply stayed on and slipped under the net. In France, as has been pointed out, it's illegal to record ethnic origin or religious affiliation in the census. So what we really have to go by are pointedly low quasi-official estimates, and we have no real way to separate out extremists in the Muslim population there any more than we do extremist Christian radicals in the Christian population here. In Europe, the transformation of a post-colonial migrant labor population into a population susceptible to radical millenarian recruitment, and in some cases to martyrdom, came in two stages, I think. The first stage clearly linked to social isolation, displacement, and the nostalgia for old traditional certainties had to do with the at first muted and often officially indulged and at least tacitly condoned demands for exceptionalism within the law. It took the form of demands for sexual segregation at schools, then separate schools, then exemption for gym classes from certain kinds of science classes. I think of a parallel with the battle over biology classes in our own Heartland schools, and you transfer that to Europe. This was followed in Western Europe by demands of exemption from corrupting Western literature, especially for girls, exemptions from dress codes for girls, uncovered faces, no basketballs in basketball and burqas. It also involved demands for unregulated Quranic education in the public schools. Jan can describe this much better than I can, but the two court battles that I know in Europe had to do, in Germany, had to do with the Lande of Berlin and Bavaria, both recently had cases brought by Muslim groups demanding Islamic education for Muslim children in public schools. Now, it was their right to demand it. All public school children in Germany have the right to religious instruction. This is why talking about secularism in Germany, and Jan will point this out, is much more complicated than we think. But the problem was that there weren't really any German university-accredited teachers to provide that education in German, and the result was that, at least for a while, those classes have been in the hands of imams with literally no one in charge who knows what they are teaching. The example I know best about radicalism among the Muslim population in Europe really has to do with France, where Muslims, under the influence of a new generation of imams, ask the old liberal imams in France about this because they're under terrible, terrible threat. Anyway, the new imams recruited through the Brotherhood in Egypt and often trained in Pakistani madrasi and installed in storefront mosques in France. They were demanding exemption from French education laws, which were written in 1905 after more than a century of battle between Catholics and Protestants over the separation of church and state, and which were applied to minors in the country's public school system. I think that one of the myths of the real traditional force for a separation of church and state in France is not appreciated in this country. The Veil Law was read in this country in a way as a kind of sudden anti-immigrant piece of legislation, but it's in fact been around again. I remember that Ashcroft filed an amicus curiae for an 11 or 12-year-old girl who had been sent home from school, a public school in Oklahoma, for actually wearing a chador to class because it was against the rules of the public school system in Oklahoma. And he filed an amicus curiae on behalf of the girl and her parents saying that if we allowed this thing to continue, we would be like godless France. But that was a misperception of France. The veil debate is a debate that that began with a Catholic-Protestant debate a few hundred years ago and took a lot of time and anguish and fighting to iron out. But I had come to France to cover the veil debate, and I was full of First Amendment indignation when I came. I thought it was a terrible abuse of civil rights to tell anyone what to wear to public school. But I left convinced that the French government was right, that the veil in public schools, since no one was talking about the rights of adults, even adult university students, to wear whatever they wanted, but minors in public schools, was the tip of an iceberg in terms of something that is really incredibly troubling as much to moderate Muslims as to moderate Christians and Jews in France, was the demand for exemption under French law. In other words, an exemption out of the social contract, an exemption out of the assumptions of citizenship having to do with a commonly held adherence to a body of law and practices. And I think that's probably what defines citizenship in any secular democracy. We see it at risk all over the place now. I have just had a letter about a woman I know in Berlin, a German-Turkish woman's rights lawyer named Seren Ates, who had received so many threats from the husband of the women she was counseling that she had to stop practicing. So this has been on my mind a great deal. The second phase of the process is, of course, jihad post 9/11, post Iraq, post the kind of ferocious backlash that used to be the province of neo-Nazis and the Front National and Carabinieri tossing Muslim immigrants some into the Adriatic. The backlash in Europe against Muslim immigrants has been over the top. It's been so bad. The jihad shares with the American evangelical Christians a belief in the divine mission, in fact, a duty to that mission and a literal notion of election. That is, to a place in heaven where the metaphors of the surahs are translated into physical reality, the famous virgins, or you could say into the kind of afterlife that certainly beats anything the Pope has to offer in eternity. And it means I'm drawing on reporting from Holland this past year, Muslim areas that are literally no-go areas to descending Muslims, not just for the police, but for moderate Muslims, for anyone in government, or indeed for any citizen not part of that community. It means the belief that you are living not just among infidels, but among enemies, and it means the imperative to force your own prohibitions on an entire society, including prohibitions against free speech and assimilation. I think we can see huge parallels here with what we're all fearing from this court in terms of women's issues, in terms of issues of dissent, in terms of issues of government surveillance, in terms of the notion that one is not American if one dissents. There are huge parallels in, I guess you could call it political apostasy. There are huge parallels here with what we're seeing among radical Islamists. In Holland, anyway, the murder of Theo van Gogh was a case in point, and so were the death threats against the Dutch Somali legislator, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and so, of course, is the backlash that followed it. The responsibility for this state of affairs is something we all know, but the fanaticism that used to be the province of a couple of crazy people in each village now exists in what you could call the global village. And the speed with which millenarian Christianity and millenarian Islam has spread among the young has a parallel, as I said, with the speed with which America became born again. Given the clandestinity of the jihadists, which is different because of the cell structure of the actual activists, it's almost impossible to track numbers. And the kind of internet surveillance that might track it with more accuracy is frankly unacceptable to most people, and should be. They may be smaller in numbers than we think, but as the activists here in the cause of a fundamentalist Christian state, the activist in the secular West, where most Muslims are simply trying to get on with their lives the way the rest of us are, the activists are, as everywhere, the extremists. And this is the unanticipated part of the new equation. They are happy to die killing other people. Now, which brings us back to the Pope, and then I'm almost finished. The Pope wasn't really talking about Muslims at all. He was probably sending a coded message to Catholics who might be tempted to join in the Protestant evangelical warriors now undermining the power of the church in South and Central America and in the still Christian parts of Africa and Asia. It's a concern he shares with mainstream Protestants, with the rectors of the Paris and Marseille mosques, and with the liberal Jewish rabbis confronted with a Lubavitcher Briesmobil. But as I said, there are no real economic or sociological or political explanations for these cycles of religious radicalisms, only contributing factors and the hope that we can survive this one. There are also questions that have to do with notions of history, the old Tolstoyan question as to whether the masses move history or the man moves history, whether history is a tidal wave or a shot to the heart of an archduke. But we're, I think, all of us in a kind of future shock right now, and I'd like to hear comments about it during the discussion. A kind of McLuhan-like medium is the message world, where we can try to control or subvert or undermine or counter the message of extremism. We can even try to be better, kinder people when it comes to dealing with it. But we really have no idea of how to master the media that spreads the message, which I think is why it's so slippery to try and talk about religion in America or Europe now. We know the symptoms, but not the elements that could give us a diagnosis. A last example, the Danish cartoon crisis. As you probably know, there is nothing in the Quran that specifically forbids images of the Prophet, and it's important to remember that it is not Muhammad, but God speaking through Muhammad in the Quran, who is literally unrepresentizable. The suggestion that images of Muhammad are forbidden comes from the Hadith, the commentaries and stories and as told to interpretations of the Prophet's life and pronouncements of what he actually meant by what he was said to have said, not as God's interpreter, but as a man. The humanity of Muhammad is very, very important in Islam. And the Persians have traditionally shown the Prophet in their miniatures and in their storytelling scrolls. And so of Indian Muslims, and in fact most Muslim communities with strong representational traditions. But after the cartoons were published, those details went by the board and the interdiction became accepted fact. And not just among Muslims, but even in the Western press, where the issue was never really the cartoons, which were published to test the limits of self-censorship in a Western country and could be read in an entirely opposite way. They could be seen as not as insults, but as comments on the political appropriation of Muhammad's name and sanctity by radicals with an unholy agenda. They were certainly anodyne when you compare them to the Holocaust cartoons now on display in Tehran or the animated series on the Protocol of the Elders of Zion, which was produced in Saudi Arabia and broadcast and rebroadcast throughout the Arab world at a rate comparable only to reruns of Law and Order. So it wasn't so much the reaction, but the technological speed of misinformation with which that reaction spread from Copenhagen really all the way to Indonesia, that puts us into a reality whose significance we can't really gauge with any more accuracy than we can predict the next victims of a suicide bomber or the reach of a far-right Christian television network here at home with its call to holy war. Think back 15 years ago to the fatwa against Salman Rushdie, a Muslim citizen of Britain. Do you remember how exceptional, how unthinkable that was? Now, once we figure out what has happened in those 15 years, both with really every monotheism and a good dose of Hindu radicalism thrown in, what's happened besides the arrival of bin Laden, or for that matter, George Bush, will probably be able to begin to explain more about the world we're living in now. Thank you.
Jane has introduced you to this great religious revival that is sweeping the world. She has talked about Americans and Muslims. And I'll start from the other side, that is from majority white Christian or post-Christian secular Europe, which is supposed to be an exception to the rule of religious revival. And let's have a look at that. And maybe you'll see that on some of the issues, Jane Cramer has touched, I have a slightly different perspective, maybe a little bit more relaxed about this phenomenon of religious revival. If we talk about religion and politics in the U.S. and in Europe, and if we look at it from the European point of view, the first fact I think we have to take into account is how diverse Europe is in this with regard to this subject. And as you might say, is the U.S., if you think of the red states and the blue states and the divided country, the split in the country, the culture wars that are fought here. But that's true culturally, even politically. But at least the legal framework, of course, regulating the relationship between church and state, religion and politics, is a common one for all the U.S. States, that is the U.S. Constitution. Whereas in Europe, church-state relations differ from country to country. You have the very strict French model of laïcité, so strict that religious affiliation is not even mentioned in the state statistics. The French state officially doesn't know how many Muslims or Jews or Christians live in France because it's not on the books. On the other hand, you have the UK, where there's an established religion, the state religion, with the Queen as the head of the Anglican Church. And to make the picture even more complicated, the question of whether there is this kind of established religion is not identical with the question of how important a role religion does play in the public life. For example, I remember when the German parliament and government moved from Bonn to Berlin, and there was a new building, the Reichstag, where the parliament was, where the deputies met, and this building was inaugurated. There was a short ecumenical religious service, and a Lutheran and minister and a Catholic priest praying together the Lord's Prayer, the Pater Noster. And I was there with a friend and colleague from the UK. And afterwards, he said to me that this would have never been possible in Great Britain. So they have a state religion with the Queen as the head of the church, but this kind of public display of piety or something like that would have been impossible. Nor does a prominent role of religion in public life mean that people are religious. For example, in Germany, the churches are empty. But the churches play a very prominent role in public life. They sit on the board of the public broadcasting companies. They have all sorts of privileges and rights. Not so in Poland, where the people, where church attendance is much higher and the Catholic faith is much more deeply rooted. But the legal status of the church is less prominent than in much more secular Germany. So you could go on in describing this kind of diversity. For example, you normally would think that the situation in Spain and Italy is rather similar, Mediterranean countries, Catholic tradition, but it's not. I mean, in Spain, there's a vital anti-clerical tendency due to the fact that the Catholic Church used to support the Franco dictatorship, whereas in Italy, still Rome, as the city where the Pope is the reason for this kind of respect for the Catholic Church, much more so than in many other countries. So that is the first point, that Europe, with regard to the relationship between religion and politics, is not monolithic at all. My second point is, having said that it's nevertheless true that Europe is much more secular than the US. Everybody knows that, much has been written about it. Europe's secularism, together with its lack of economic dynamism and its low birth rates, is one of the reasons why American conservatives despise the continent. Maybe it's one of the reasons why U.S. liberals like it, Europe. I want to single out just one aspect of this kind of religious, cultural, transatlantic divide, that is how prominent U.S. religious attitudes have become in inspiring European anti-Americanism. And there is anti-Americanism. Most European politicians would tell you that it does not exist, that it's only about Bush. I think that's a little bit disingenuous. There is such a thing as anti-Americanism, but it has changed over the past 10 or 20 years. 20 years ago, it was primarily about capitalism as opposed to the European welfare state. It was also about foreign policy hawkishness and militancy as opposed to the European inclination towards détente, but it was very much about capitalism. And now it's about Bible-thumping fundamentalist Christianity. If you ask people in Europe why they don't like Bush, they will not so much talk about... They will, of course, talk about the war and him being a warmonger. They will not so much talk about him being an oil man as they would have done, I think, 20 or 30 years ago, but about this habit of having these moral certainties, the missionary zeal that seems to have to do with him being a reborn evangelical Christian. There's something important going on. As Europe views the U.S. as increasingly pious, devout, and even fundamentalist, it defines itself more and more as secular. This kind of secularism, it becomes a cornerstone of European identity. Sometimes I think, why was it so difficult, or was it impossible, to convince Europeans that the Christian heritage or God should be mentioned in the European Constitutional Treaty? That was an important debate 2 or 3 years ago. I think it had to do with the Europeans thinking of themselves as people who don't refer to God in this way, because they saw at the US and decided that they did not like that. And it will be interesting to see whether this changes when it's no longer the US that is primarily seen as the other to Europe, but, for example, Islam. I think it would be interesting, I could imagine, it's simply guesswork, that people today, with all these debates about Mohammed cartoons and the row about the Pope's Regensburg lecture and so on, that people in Europe today might be more in favor of including a reference to Christianity in the EU constitutional treaty than they were 2 or 3 or 4 years ago when this debate, when the issue was discussed. Now, the third point obviously has to be to try to answer the question whether this European secularism is a good thing. My answer is not necessarily, or to put it another way, less so than liberal Americans might tend to think. I certainly don't want to argue anything like believers are right and non-believers are wrong, and don't want to discuss matters of faith. What I want to argue is that there is a danger of what you could call religious illiteracy in Europe, in mainstream, secular, white, post-Christian Europe. That means that people are in a way ill-equipped to understand and manage one of the major driving forces of the 21st century, which is religion. For example, if you think of the Muhammad cartoons and what Jane mentioned, I think that most people, or many people in Europe, simply did not understand what was going on there, how people could take their faith so seriously, how they could really be offended by this kind of cartoons. They simply did not get it. And sometimes I think that in the U.S., the reaction in the U.S. was different. It had to do, well, there is a habit here of respecting one's sensitivities in a country that is made up, I mean, that it's a country of immigrants where everybody comes with his heritage, and it would not be a good idea to quarrel about that. So that is a tradition. But it is also that Americans nowadays might find it easier to understand why other people take their faith so seriously, even in a way we find unreasonable. But for Europe, it was difficult to understand. My suspicion is that this kind of religious illiteracy makes people insecure in dealing with other people, other cultures, and other religions. And maybe it's not accidental. The ultra-tolerant and multicultural Netherlands, after some bad experiences with Muslim immigration, has turned around 180 degrees, or close to 180 degrees, and become a country with this serious streak of xenophobia and bigotry. Or, for example, it's not Catholic Bavaria where Muslim immigrants are beaten up in Germany. It is the post-communist East. It has more to do with social degradation, perhaps, than with religion, but it's not necessarily having a religious identity of your own that makes you intolerant of other people's beliefs. So, this was, I'd like to stop here and leave all the rest for the discussion.
If you want to ask a question, please come to the microphone.
I am from Holland, and I study journalism here at BU. I'm a graduate student, and I followed all the incidents in my country, and I am appalled by, you know, the mentality right now and how there is no dialogue whatsoever. What I thought of in terms of free speech in the turmoil after the murder of Van Gogh, uh-huh. There was an American reporter who said, well, the things that Van Gogh said or stated and he could get away with in this country would be unthinkable in the U.S. because you have this First Amendment. We have a broad free speech, but we could not publish these. There's this sort of respect and sort of our publishers would not even think of publishing these insults. So how do you?
I would say that the decision of most American publishers to publish or not publish something has to do first with economics and two with the readership not wanting to offend readership and certainly not wanting to offend advertisers. I think Van Gogh, I mean, he said reprehensible things. Right. But he was right, actually, in an American tradition that began with people like Lenny Bruce. Don't forget, he said those things as a stand-up comic and as a performer. And he also said them. You're right, though, on a television program. I think that you certainly could get away with that in America. Mm-hmm. You probably could not get away with it in the New York Times, or the Wall Street Journal. But
Van Gogh actually published for all the quality in quality newspapers. So
I know he did. I'm suggesting that it's not simply a question of sensitivity on the part of big American publishers not to publish insulting racial remarks. I think it's much more complicated than that. I don't think that it's because we're so nice, necessarily.
But doesn't she have a point that in this country, with, for example, race being such a charged issue, there is a tradition of trying not to offend other communities, more so than in Europe?
Well, in Europe, there are laws to protect certain religious groups against
against hate speech.
Yes, yeah. And here, where the First Amendment is so much larger, there's this sort of moral, maybe, I don't know, this moral grounds on which
it's because the First Amendment is so broad. And I think it's also, you brought this up about the states. We are all immigrants. Nobody is not an immigrant. Ultimately, if you've arrived at any sort of personal civilization at all, you realize the insanity of hatred.
Yeah, have to accept these kind of differences.
We're here. Would that mean that, you know, I couldn't open a magazine or turn on a television channel and not hear something like Van Gogh? I could certainly turn on HBO and hear it every night. It may also be because we are basically, especially in the cycle we're in now, such a fervent religious country.
Now, there's been a lot of mention of the Danish cartoons and the backlash that followed them, and there was recently, I read about a case where production of Mozart's Idomeneo was pulled from Berlin Opera before there was even any backlash. There were four heads of severed religious leaders, Buddha, Poseidon, Jesus, and Muhammad, and the production was pulled before it is even set to premiere because of feared religious violence, and it was condemned, I know, in Germany as cowardly by many religious leaders. And the question I wanted to put forward is, why are so many people nowadays so fearful of saying anything against Islam, and why has it become so incorrect? Since when and why has this religion obtained such an immunity that is, for some reason, not available to any other religion? And why is it incorrect for somebody to bash Islam, whereas it is perfectly fine to bash Judaism, Hinduism, and Christianity? I'm saying, you know, either bash all or don't bash any.
Well, my first answer is that it's not necessary to do everything you're allowed to do. I mean, that is the point with the cartoons. Yeah. Of course, I would defend everybody's right to draw them, to print them, to publish them. It could nevertheless be bad taste. And that is the one thing. And the other thing, of course, this kind of cautiousness has to do with fear, but also with the kind of circumspection. Think of the Pope, of Benedict XVI. I think the problem with what he said was not that it was wrong. It was not. He was really just quoting this emperor. All these things were true. But he got his roles mixed up. He wanted to speak like the professor he used to be at the Regensburg University, and he forgot that the Pope is always the Pope, a religious leader whose words have consequences. And if we look at the consequences, we might conclude that it is better to refrain from this kind of comments. That does not mean that you are not entitled to them, but that you have to take into account what happens. And if it's really better for Christian Islamic or Western Islamic relations afterwards than it was before. So freedom comes with responsibility. That is not cowardice, I think. He forgot what his role as a pope is. He should have thought about it maybe a moment longer. That is not telling that Islam is immune. He wanted to begin a kind of dialogue that is more critical, of interreligious dialogue that is more critical perhaps than what his predecessor did, and maybe he succeeds. But nevertheless, you have to think about the consequences of your words.
Thank you so much. This was really wonderful.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Whose God Is It? Religion in the U.S. and Europe. Speaking was Jane Kramer, European correspondent for The New Yorker, and Jan Ross, staff writer for Die Zeit, a German weekly newspaper. We began with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzenska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Clozelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.